And when she first went to the moon, her boyfriend, Reston Wills, was her age. And they're the ones that set up farming on the moon, while everybody else was doing military bases or mining bases. They were investigating how to turn lunar soil into very fertile growing soil under domes. And they pioneered the architecture of taking geodesic domes and multiplying the molecular layers so that with several hundred thousand layers doing various functions, one could have not only a mile diameter dome, but eventually an 8 mile diameter dome, and eventually they would dome all of Plato crater, 65 miles in diameter. It would be a dome larger than the state of Rhode Island. And that the crops being grown, because they were handled aesthetically and analytically completely, they were completely pure, going back to the original tastes, so that tomatoes were really tomatoes like they used to be tomatoes, etc. Granny was left on the moon, and Rustin went back to Earth and became the first trillionaire. Granny never forgave him, but always took it upon herself, because she couldn't have children. She didn't want to be with someone else for that. So she began raising all the kids, generations, now in the third generation. She resumed looking out, instantly meditating again the lunar beauty and slow unfoldment from mere imbrium plane into ancient highland configuration. Hadley, nearly 5 kilometers high, swelled enormous, with slopes massing into prominence from broad swells. At 1,000 meters and 1,000 kilometers per hour, this unfold disclosed sweetly to Granny's proportional sense. The arcing tour bus glinted sharp in sunlight, a pale blue glow in the shadows as it circled for a landing. Granny thought about old Arthur C. Clarke's story, A Fall of Moon Dust, about the tour vehicle that was swallowed by moon dust, the Selene. Granny's name was Selene. Sarah Selene, 80 years ago, first reading that novel, she knew she would live on the moon. Granny rubbed an arched white eyebrow with 2 nimble fingers, painted nails, no rings. 37 years mystically involved with raising natives, not tribal, but of a new civilization, the star system civilization. Our star Sol and complete family could never be more than an armed neutrality, which the Clark protagonist called the moon. Terrestrial egos, complete with Freudian testosterone cigars stoked amidst Gustav Klimt style salon matrons, haughtily gelled in Viennese aspect abstractions. Whew, Granny went way beyond that long ago. Tallish, bobbed white hair over long earrings, calm but critically sharp, ebullient without exaggeration. She observed Nokomis, her best. Brushing back a wisp under slender red-nailed fingers, glancing again, seeing Nokomis, to music, Radio Luna was playing in the background, the Crater Junction Jackson Hour. Nokomis, alert, smiled softly, feeling Granny's look, and intuited her reconnoiter. Taller by inches and athletic in prowess, she patiently continued to show 3 girls how to do it exactly again, placed their D-mags above the ankle, not on the ankle or swell of the calf. And why here, girls? Sonorous lunar afternoon program played on Radio Luna, mellow undertone to this careful instruction. not to make messes, semi, for, usually asking only long strings of whys. To keep dust from clogging equipment, said Pamela, 8, pretty and generally quietly alert, currently playing up to 14-year-old Spenny, sitting alone aside, observing. Radio Luna played Hovhannes's symphony to Mount St. Helens. The limpid beauty of Hovhannes's 50th symphony accumulated tones. So the de-dusting field is maximized on the step and not on the vector trailing, which scrambles wide fields. Judy, age 12, added this with all the prompt certitude. She also eyed Spenny quietly aside, but at 14 he was not quite yet interested. Nokomis nodded at each reply, adding, working D-mags won't track up our home. Only a 20-centimeter range. Granny smiled. Jillions of tracks would clutter our planet pretty bad. Nokomis checked Granny again. Direct, brief look. Ready? Then resumed demonstrating helmet tinting by calibration readout. And then to skip over to the last page of this early section. Say again, garbled, came Granny's immediate reply, fiddling with the Demagos. Three men not far from you, upslope, south, not native, no Demags, dusty bunch, acting peculiar, her blurred image straightened up. Sneaky. No comas, no copy, say again. She turned fast to Spenny, nearby in the bus aisle, pointing in whisper, did you link with Cassini? Emergency? Can't get a clear signal. Link check, Granny. Link good. He shrugged and waited on Granny's call. No comas, repeat clearly. Granny frowned, intense brown eyes drilling into the Lorraine through the glass port frame. Conscious field, full, wide, strong. Not able to hear, Granny, but keeping to her report. Yep. They're near those men, but they don't see them yet. Those boys. Uh-oh. She planted her jet poles and raised a field lens to throw laser infrared. Needed to send a recorded sequence to Cassini Control as well as to Granny, but now demanding the Moonbus control panel. Granny glared at readouts, tearing away plastic storage which some idiot had sealed over them. Never compromise equipment, however little used. Where was she? Where were those boys? What in hell is going on out there? Two of those men have grabbed the boys. Hey, some kind of hidden passage, a buried entrance point, a port, slopeside. The comus increased magnification 50-fold, hoping to get facial ID. Well, telemetry rolled, but she felt uneasy, troubled. Granny with Cassini kids gathered around the blurry imagery as the secret hatchway on screen closed. Moon dust settled, vibrated over the spot, obviously cascading from somebody's sound wave cover-up. Well, Granny never finished. The picture feed leapt upward, showing black sky. Damn. Nokomis had turned again to replant her jet poles. Steep slope. At the edge of helmet vision, she caught a ghostly glow. They're on jet skis. She turned abruptly from a skein of shadow and shards of light. An inhuman, elongated face stared at her. Coming swiftly at her, pale features blurred by some kind of energy mist that snaked out from inky depths. Reflexively, she dropped to one knee, sweeping a jet pole into lance-like defense. Suddenly, her form lit up with jagged orange light. Pings of sparkle clustered around her head, then a sizzling blue ray enveloped the cringing figure She crumpled into the downslope dust, glowing a sick pink. Her voice disappeared in a weak vowel growl. The strange ghost strode to her, straddled her, grabbed her limp body up as it slowly faded back into lunar shadows. Red-rimmed eyes phosphorescent in the darkness. Nokomis laid splayed over skinny metallic arms. Only static sizzled over the intercom. Static visuals indicating only gray slope under black sky. All the kids stared in fear at the holographic chaos behaving like silent flames amid background static crackle. Then each looked in scared awe to see what Granny would do. Stunned for the first time in 35 years, she still patted the nearest child, Simi, nodding quietly as if she knew. But somebody had just challenged their entire world. That's how it begins. The challenges that are already here are minuscule compared to the challenges that are rushing like a time storm. And there is no way to sidestep it. So we have to learn to jet ski and to be at home in many different facets of worlds and lives than we have ever had to do before. The first transformation of our species was achieved underground in the Paleolithic caverns, in the underworlds, which allowed for our species to go into an initiation that was similar to a death experience of being buried, but it was done consciously, so that the death was a transformation rather than a terminal, life-ending experience. What we are facing now is going above not only ground, but above grounds, into space, into a sense that is almost unfathomable, and the first person to ever experience that was Colonel Ed White on a Gemini mission with Jim McDivitt. It was the first EVA in NASA history, in world history, of their Gemini capsule opening the door in space. They were in their space suits with the feeds. And White went outside on the first EVA. And there was a famous photograph that McDivitt took of him that was on the cover of Life magazine, with White not only outside of the capsule and the life feed coming from the navel, but the rather large hose that had all of the telemetry and the oxygen and so forth was gold-coated, so it looked like a gold umbilical cord curling around. And the curls were not geometric, but they were very much like what we're used to now in seeing structures of complex proteins. They're not little nice compartments that are just arranged like on a geometric drawing board, but they're like Miro paintings, where all of this happens to be a new gestalt of life. And it was the umbilical cord that drew White's attention to the fact that he was free of all contact with the capsule except for this. And when he turned to look down, his hand came up, his white EVA pseudo-asbestos glove, and he eclipsed the entire Earth with his hand. And you could tell from McDivitt's telemetry, which is on the report detailed of that Gemini flight, he said there's something going on with Colonel White, Major White, because he looked back from his hand out into deep space and uttered an astonished sigh, because looking into space is looking into infinity. It isn't that the blackness is there anywhere, and it isn't blackness. It's clarity forever, so far that light hasn't ever gone that far, and that's why it's dark. NASA control, Houston control, kept saying, come back in, come back in. And White would not respond, and he was not going to come back in because he had been born. Literally born free. So they instructed McDivitt to pull him back in by the umbilical cord, which he did. They warned him not to talk about it. And unfortunately, he was one of the Apollo astronauts killed on Apollo 1, along with Gus Grissom and Roger Chaffee. Because in those days, the early Apollo was filled with pure oxygen, and the slightest friction spark set it ablaze, and they had no chance. They were charred cinders. That experience of White was the first indication that there is a new kind of wonder that is approaching and is here for many who are able to see it. One of the great science fiction early trilogies was Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, and eventually he wrote others to go with it. And after he passed away, three of the greatest science fiction writers wrote another trilogy, and the first is called Foundation's Fear, but the second is called Foundation in Chaos, because anyone who, as they see it, goes off-world is subject to a scrambling of dimensional positioning, and a chaos fever comes into play, and not only comes into play for individuals, but is transmitted genetically then for sometimes hundreds of years, and it takes sometimes thousands of years to overcome this kind of psychic vertigo. That psychic vertigo in Asimov's Foundation series is not due to aliens. Asimov's universe does not have aliens per se, but has something that becomes almost archetypally threatening. It has robots. It has robots that evolve like we have evolved, only faster, more comprehensive, and the entire interface of man was illuminated in a novel called The Caves of Steel, where a robot named R. Daniel Ladlaw is able to interface psychically with a human being, a psychic detective. And the follow-up novel was called The Naked Sun, and eventually there was a third, making a trilogy, The Robots of Dawn. All of the Asimov robot novels became eventually superseded even by this collection called Robots in Empires. And this is a limited edition of about 600 copies of this. There's a regular trade edition of it. The import that Asimov delivers in the robot series and the foundation series is that our technical capacity, being of a higher order than our natural limitations, can only be held into balance if we have an aesthetic wholeness capable also of making the technical, the analytical capacity perfected. That if we leave it unperfected, it's like suffering an incompleteness in the natural cycle, and you end up where the distortion takes over. The artificiality crimps the natural cycle so that it no longer works naturally, is not able to be completed integrally, and one is diseased. That what is lurking is a possibility without a prismatic person interface. Technology is going to make a crimp in our capacity to have civilization. One of the drawbacks, and Asimov was brilliant enough to address himself massively to this, is that one has to understand the past in new ways, in refined ways, in order to go into the future creatively. Asimov said that when he was approached to do a future history, he was stunned until he remembered that he had read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire in many volumes twice from cover to cover, and saw that Gibbon's massive decline and fall of the Roman civilization was exactly what would repeat again. Because the early use of history was Thucydides in the Peloponnesian War, who wrote in the beginning of it, of that work, about the time of Plato, "Knowing what I know now, I write this history because this pattern will repeat itself again unless man changes himself." That the cycle, the integral cycle of the nature of this situation phenomenally and symbolically, replays itself so that the history occurs in a cycle which is unstoppable. It will always play out that way. In fact, in Roman times, the times of Augustus Caesar, when the Roman Empire was founded, they saw it as the beginning of a new golden age. But the kicker in that is that the Roman sense of ages, of time forms, was on a cyclic basis. That there were four ages. There was an age of gold, followed by an age of silver, followed by an age of bronze, and then finally finishing the decay into an age of iron, where everything was chaotic, violent, murderous, and bringing life almost to an end. And only by Herculean efforts would a new golden age be able to come, but it would come in the sense that it was a time bomb, because that golden age will also decay progressively, and that each time it does, that iron age phase becomes more and more violent, more and more terminal, and requires more and more miraculous events, persons, to make a new golden age. The first revision, the first transformation, the first double transformation of that is the book, The Gospel According to Matthew. When you look at The Gospel According to Matthew, he gives, these are the generations of Jesus leading to Jesus. He says, He is the son of David, the son of Abraham. And right away, you get a scalar going back, just like the four ages of 500 years, 2,000 years. But for Matthew, one goes back to David 1,000 years before, one goes back to Abraham 2,000 years before. But from Abraham to David, Matthew writes, it's 14 generations, but from David to coming back from the exile is 14 generations, but it's only 500 years. And the next 500 years is likewise 14 generations from coming back from the exile to Jesus. So that you get a new triadic proportion in the gospel according to Matthew, where it isn't a decay like in man's sense of the natural cycle running out of energy, going into entropy, but rather there is a divine accrual of not only a line of development, but an accumulation of penetrating energy, so that when the time forms come through their various cycles to their completeness, they also have an extra dimensionality of perfection. In our time, indeed for the last several hundred years, the gospel according to Matthew has been subjected more and more to criticism, to investigations, to footnotes, and the Anchor Bible edition of the Gospel of Matthew even questions whether there was someone named Matthew. It was probably written by committees over many decades, maybe several generations. This is what Matthew looked like in the time of Jesus. This is a portrait that I have made out of evidence and have artistically tailored it so that it can be presented. Not only was he an actual man, he was an extraordinarily exact man. He was named Matthew because that's the name that Jesus gave him. His family name was Levi, and his father's name was Alphaeus. He was Levi bar Alphaeus. But he was called Matthew because he was the grace of God, according to Jesus, designation of his personal quality. And always the characterization of him in a mythic sense was he was a tax collector. The fact is that he was on the cusp of two very large caravan routes. And he was the customs chief interface of all of the caravan routes that came from the Middle East and collected in Damascus and then came down through the northern part of Galilee and from there went to the coast. And at the coast, there were the shipping ports, Sidon, Tyre, Caesarea. And it was the way in which then goods that would be coming off the Mediterranean, eventually farther and farther afield, all the way out into the Atlantic coasts of Africa and of Europe, so that the trade as far as the Irish Sea was linked together with the trade going overland as far as northern India. And Matthew was in charge of keeping track of the meticulous generations, not only the names and the dates, but the patterning. And the patterning showed that the last 14 generations, there were 12 generations and then Jesus. And the 14th generation was the transformation of Jesus to the Messiah. So that it had, in this one person the capacity to become harmonic cosmically. And that this was in order to bring the dimensions of time and space fully into a complementarity, so that the dimensions of consciousness and the dimensions of time and space would be able to come together in such a way that their complementarity, being a ninth dimension approach of accumulated penetration, would be able to enter in what we today would call hyperspace. No longer limited to phenomenal space. Not even able to be indexed by a noumenal prismatic person space. But a pairing, a symmetry of phenomenal and noumenal space into a third level of a hyperspace. When we come next week, we'll talk about how a 10-dimensional hyperspace has an extraordinary high array of not only possibilities, but of being able to literally bring true anything that can be put forth, as long as the aesthetic, imaginative creativity is in harmony and in tune, literally, with the historical analytic. The crimp in the works is not the high end, is this possible? It certainly not only is possible, many civilizations in galaxies without count have achieved this. The crimp is not being able to handle the energies of history. Because while the mythic horizon is a horizon of the flow of experience and has a time sense of the story, the beginning, the middle, and the end, history has no beginning, middle, and end. It keeps enlarging its parentheses, both forward and backward, and only when they're balanced, the future with the new past, does the kaleidoscopic consciousness of history become not manageable, not handleable, but intelligible. And without it, increasingly, experience in the natural mode becomes swamped by the inability to handle the complexity of the flow. 100 years ago, almost everyone had the conviction that the first man was like Adam, and as an Irish bishop, Usher, found by computing back, that was about 6,000 years ago, 4004 BC. That man was just recently come out of some kind of creation, and obviously could not be traced back to previous species. And all of this has occurred increasingly, so that we know now that our ancestry in terms of the pre-DNA world, the old RNA world of viruses, of bacteria, goes on this planet alone back more than 3 1/3 billion years. We are refined to be further refined. That is not only our nature and our promise, it is how we live in the sense of the reality of ourselves. Our capacity in order to do this means balancing the equanimity of our symbolic structure on the four dimensions of a natural cycle and the four dimensions of a differential conscious ecology, and bringing them into a play whereby they become a musical scale, a scalar, literally an octave by which to sing. The old Hermetic statement is that when we learn to sing praise on this scale, we develop an ear for a kind of music that we were unable to hear before ever, not only naturally, but our personal refinement had not been energized enough to hear this singing in a hyperspace. And that when we can, we are welcomed. We are no longer the aliens in a cosmos that has already been singing for 12 billion years, but we're invited to join the choir. This is a whole different scalar from self-help groups, from making adjustments for success groups. This is a completely different, a differential series of qualities and approachable. The 2010 1 year, four seasons of excursion will be like a voyage of the Argonauts, but a voyage really of the astronauts for real. Next week we'll take a look at the quality of visioning where the past and the future are balanced in such a way that the pair of pairs making two squared and the pair of pairs paired making two cubed gives us a new precision by which to understand where it is possible for phenomenality to occur, to exist, and where it will not exist because it cannot occur. In terms of a star system, this is called Bode's Law, and that the spacing of planets is where they are because of the gravitational and angular momentum and the way in which an entire star system is set up. The relationship is always such that the further out you go in terms of the square, the faster you have to go in terms of the cube. And that one can always come to understand how the next place, the next time is right, is because their relationship will always be oneness. You will always mathematically be able to return back to the confidence of the integral cycle of the natural, because its proportion will always have a one as the expression of the ratiability. This is called being ratiable and not just rational. I hear by the crisis that we need to adjourn.